702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
17 minutes past 10. Welcome back. You're listening to Gershwell Brooks in for Aubrey Masango. And I'm looking forward to the next conversation because for tonight's South Africans doing great things, we are joined by Jo Rust, South Africa's top female solo adventurer, who's taking the mental health industry by storm, all while using her journey to help others. And I'm really intrigued to hear her story. Of course, as you mentioned, in 2013, Jo set the record for the first solo woman in history to circumnavigate the African continent on a motorcycle. Good evening to you, Jo, and thank you for agreeing to chat to us this evening.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, I can hear you.
Brilliant stuff. Okay. I think for me, it's obviously there's plenty to talk about this evening with you, but let's start with that epic journey that you took back in 2013. I understand that you started off after riding a bicycle all the way from Johannesburg to Cape Town, a feat I can't imagine myself ever accomplishing. You then wanted to take it a step further and go around the continent, but then you settled on a motorbike instead.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was kind of a decision that was made for me. The idea was to go around Africa on a bicycle. But then I made it as far as northern Angola. And then on one fateful day, a black Ford Bucky pickup, whatever you want to call it, pulled over on the side of the road, which wasn't anything out of the ordinary. You know, a lot of people used to stop to want to ask me questions because, you know, girl on her own on a bicycle, middle of nowhere, is not something you see every day. And when these guys got out of the car, when I realized that they were armed with machetes and knives, I knew that they were not there to chat. I ended up having all my belongings stolen, and that's when I returned back home. And in a miraculous turn of events, well, I decided, number one, maybe the bicycle is a bit too slow and I need a bit of horsepower. Mm. And that's when I discovered the internal combustion engine. And so then I started over on a motorcycle.
That is quite awesome because, I mean, and I know it's weird in retrospect to think of it, but I guess at the time you figured that, listen, pedal power is never going to help you escape the situation. So much rather be on the back of a bike, petrol driven, and you can sort of get out of the situation. And then I guess the other thing is it makes you less vulnerable. You're constantly in motion until such time that you need to refuel or rest. What was that journey like? Take us through it. Where did you start? Where did it end? What are some of the most amazing things that you came across while on a motorbike, traveling, circumventing Africa?
Oh, it was such an amazing, amazing event in my life. And I started in Cape Agulhas and ended in Cape Agulhas.
Wow.
So I went around the continent clockwise, going up the West Coast, coming down the East Coast. And I, in the end, ended up going through 28 countries in total and covered about 45,000 kilometers, which is just a bit more than the equator, the length of the equator. And, wow. You know, never in my wildest dreams, when I set out, you know, I was so determined to do this. And I always just had the day that I actually completed this journey in my mind. But when it actually happened, when I actually got to complete this journey, like one of my favorite stories that I always tell was the last country I entered before coming back into South Africa, I came through Swaziland, was the last one. And I came through Mozambique, got to the border. Bunch of people had come to welcome me back into SA, and it was a complete surprise. I didn't know that people were going to be there. And as I handed my passport to the customs officer, he looked up at me, stamped my passport for the very last time, and said, "Welcome home, Joe."
Wow.
And and that was me. That was me, in tears, completely in tears. And it was just the realization of, wow, I've actually done this. Well, home stretch, I wasn't there yet, but I have to say, I think the most amazing part of the whole journey was just the people, all the people I met along the way. Just so warm, welcoming, caring. Everywhere I went, smiles, people wanting to rather help you than anything else. And it really, you learn so much by being exposed to other cultures, you know, and other people's way of living. And it was, the journey of a lifetime.
Absolutely stunning. I mean, it's a bucket list item of mine. I won't lie to you. It's something, and I guess it was when I saw Charlie Borman and what's his name?
Ewan McGregor.
I can't believe I forgot Ewan McGregor. He's the famous one. they did, obviously, their motorbike journeys. First, it was obviously the length of the world, and then it was
long way round, long way down, and then long way up.
Exactly. And I mean, that for me was this. I was thinking to myself, if I had the money, I would do this, you know, get a friend, get onto decent BMW GS bikes. That's not, it's an advert, so if you guys want to pay me, go ahead. and just take off. I mean, that would be the adventure of a lifetime. But throughout this journey, Joe, was it 5-star hotels every night with, I don't know, caviar and lobster? or did you have to, slum it, as we would say, without being offensive?
Yeah, I have to admit, most of it was literally pitching a tent on the side of the road or my sleeping in the bushveld somewhere under the stars. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was such a humbling experience. Yeah, it's kind of getting back to getting out of the rat race and just living. Really just living in the moment. You know, these days we all talk about being mindful and living mindfully. Well, that's what that journey helped teach me, is how to really live mindfully. Because you're literally just focusing on where I'm going right now, what I need today. I need food, I need water, I need to figure out where I'm going to stay, and I need to figure out where I'm going to get fuel. And that's it. That's all we have to worry about.
I mean, that's absolutely that's as you said, it's basic survival ultimately, but worthwhile, all of it, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, there were times where I was put up in like 5-star hotels, but those were also just such interesting stories. Like when I went through Libya, it was during the Arab Spring.
Wow.
And I was literally, you know, when everyone had left, I was like the only tourist. But they weren't allowing tourists in, but I was like the only person. And the government actually put me up in hotels, and in these 5-star hotels, and I was the only guest. And it was so eerie. It was great to have a warm bath and a bit of luxury. But at the same time, you had bombs going off around you, and it was such a bizarre experience.
And let me guess, that's the moment you thought to yourself, my timing is just phenomenal.
Well, it became a bit of a running joke, because everywhere I went, like every time I got to a country, there was trouble brewing in the country, the next country. And I just thought to myself, I don't know what's going on. I don't know it became a bit of a joke amongst my friends.
I get you. It's like you just carried the mojo with you as you went along, without even knowing it.
Okay, just entering Libya now. So what's going on in Egypt? Let's just have a look.
And I mean, you had that unfortunate situation in northern Angola. Again, I actually said it. I was lucky enough to be in sort of the northeastern parts of Angola, and that whole strip, as you go towards the coast, is beautiful, tropical, very rural, and a beautiful part of the country. But unfortunately, it has its dangerous elements. You know, from people panning for diamonds and officials trying to get bribes out of you too. Yeah, you know, it's far flung from Luanda, so people sort of do their own thing. Apart from that harrowing experience while being on a bicycle and getting pulled over by these guys on this Ford Bucky, I mean, were there other moments that had your heart racing? Maybe not as hectic, but definitely had your heart racing.
There were more harrowing experiences than that one. That one wasn't as bad.
Wow.
I actually, when I started over on the motorcycle, the day I re-entered Angola, and I love and hate telling this story because I love Angola, but telling the story, people are like, okay, I'm never going there. But that's
no, it's a stunning place, but I mean, it's a stunning place. And I guess the way you traveled is very different to how everyone else would be traveling, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so when I switched over to the motorcycle, the Angolan government actually stepped in and got in touch with me in the time when I came back home. They actually flew me back home.
Wow.
And it became this big story, and the Angolan government got in touch with me personally and said to me, you know, they're so sorry about what happened. Is there anything they can do to help me? And that's when I decided, well, I had already decided when I watched these guys take off with my bicycle that, you know what, maybe I should consider something a little faster. And then I took a chance and I said, well, I'm actually considering starting over on a motorcycle. Is there any chance you'd be interested in looking at getting involved, maybe being part sponsor? And they said to me, well, send us a proposal in the budget. And, of course, I'd never ridden a bike before. I knew nothing about traveling on a bike, what I needed. So I fervently read every online forum I could other than travel on a motorcycle, trying to figure out what I would need. Came up with a budget, sent it through to them, and 2 weeks later they came back and they said, yes, we'll cover all of it. And
wow.
So, yeah, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. But my first day back in Angola, they had, you know, organized this welcoming party, and the governor of the southern province was supposed to meet me, but he was running late and he wasn't meeting. And I said to the border officials, look, I know where I'm going. I'm going to be staying with friends, literally 50 kilometers from the border. It's a little town called Onjiva. And I went and stayed with these friends, and I sent a message to the chief of police and the local governor, and I said to them, this is where I am, just so they know. And lo and behold, I'm in Murphy's Law that night, as I was with these friends of mine, and as we finished dinner, I was sitting with my back to the door of the house, the front door, and I just saw my friend's husband stand up and his eyes go like real big, and these four guys stormed in, one with a gun, geez. One with they literally taped us to chairs, and that was probably the scariest experience. So it was these four guys, they were looking for money or whatever they could go, and taped us to the chairs and put the volume on the television so no one could hear what was going on. And my phone started ringing. They obviously took our phones, and my phone started ringing because the governor was looking for me.
Hey.
And I wasn't answering. So they came to see if I was okay. And it was literally, I mean, it's like something out of a Hollywood movie, but literally what happened was this guy, the gun he had wasn't loaded. And as he loaded it, he put it against my head. And at that moment, the governor and chief of police arrived at the front gate. I kid you not.
Wow.
And it was just absolutely insane. There was also another incident, two other incidents, one in Mauritania and one in Libya, where I was physically assaulted in a hotel room.
Ah, sorry to
But yeah, but luckily, you know, being from South Africa, being from Joburg, so before I left, I was given some training by our military, and so I was able to kick butt.
Wow. So when is the... Listen, has anyone spoken to you about the movie rights? I mean, because I'm thinking that this is an entire movie here, Joe.
It is an entire movie, I know. I've been trying... So many of my friends have said, you need to sell this to Netflix, or, you know, we need to get a movie made out of it. I mean, I wrote the book, and the idea is to turn it into a script. But, yeah, it is... I mean, things that happened were just absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's absolutely, yeah, it's. But you know, it's the most amazing thing that, you know, you're not the first person I'm speaking to that has gone on sort of a trans-African trip of some sort. A very good friend of mine years ago took a Hillman Imp and drove from... he got this crazy idea to take a Hillman Imp. And literally, you remember in the 1960s when they had those tiny minis? It was the competitor to the Mini. And he drove from Joburg to London, you know, and you know, amazing stories. And what I'm just getting at is that the similarities in the stories is that it's not always, it's not five stars, you know, it's not five star hotels all the time. It's definitely not fine cuisine and dining and lovely roads without potholes. It's roughing it. But the most amazing part for me is the fact that everyone always comes back with this massive smile on their face and saying that this is one of the greatest moments of my life. Is that the same for you?
It is. It is. I think it's because, you know, we grow through adversity. And those are the moments that we remember. I mean, if you have, if you go on a trip and it's all smooth sailing, everything is perfect, it's not memorable. It's when things goes wrong and you overcome obstacles and you go through hardships. Those are the moments that you remember, and those are the moments that you grow through and you look back at, and you know that puts a smile on your face.
Exactly, and that's the amazing bit. I mean, stories of you sitting down with you know, I don't know, fishermen and you know, in small villages, looking at the, I don't know, the goats out at pasture, while next to a campfire being entertained and hosted by a family. You have no cooking clue who they are, but they've taken you in.
Yeah, that happened many a time. I mean, on, you know, having said that, I was attacked in Libya. A very positive story was like walking into a store. Now, being a Western woman, you know, non-Muslim, walking into a store on your own is like quite something that they're not used to, and it can be quite dangerous. Actually,
it's a massive culture shock. It's North Africa. Very akin to the Middle East to some extent. Many of those people and some of the countries even see themselves more linked to the Middle East as opposed to saying linked to Africa.
Yeah, exactly. And I walked into this little shop because I needed a, you know, normal everyday stuff, food and such. And I picked the things that I need and got to the storefront, put them down. The man put it all in a bag and refused to let me pay, and he said, "Welcome to Libya."
Wow.
And, you know, I had so many similar experiences of people who would go out of their way to help me or to welcome me or to, you know, want to show me their country or their village or their family or, you know, just the, like I said, the generosity and the, the, I think it's the humanity. I think that's the word that I'm looking for. It's just phenomenal.
I mean, I'm absolutely envious of your journey. And who knows, Joe, before I get too old and too decrepit, let me raise the kids first, you know, get that part of my life out of the way. And I promise you, I'm going to save up money. I'm going to make a plan, and I'm going to go on one of these trips. I don't know. I'm going with you or without you, by the way.
You have to do it. You know?
No, it's a lifelong ambition.
Anyone.
Definitely. But, you know, the thing is, out of all of this, another passion of yours is obviously mental health. And I'd just like to understand, what's the link for you? Where did you draw sort of the parallel and what it is that you want to do in raising awareness and making us talk more around issues of mental health?
Yeah, so what no one knew at the time when I took on this great journey was that I have struggled with mental health issues all my life. From the age of 7, I suffered from severe social phobia, depression, suicidality from a very early age, from age 10. So these were difficulties that I lived with throughout my life. And going around Africa was my way of fighting back against my mental illness. And it was at a time where I was in a phase where I was being felt suicidal. And I decided, okay, if I'm not going to take my life, I'm going to go the direct opposite way And what is the biggest, scariest thing that I can think of that will challenge me in every way? Because that's what I've always been about, is how do I challenge my fears? How do I challenge my difficulties? And the biggest, scariest thing I could think of is I want to become the first woman to go around Africa. Mm. And, you know, and it started with the bicycle because I was in my 20s and I was broke and I had no money. And, you know, then the whole Angola thing happened. But I persevered, and there was just no way that I was going to give up. And at the end, I actually did it. And it was such an amazing thing when I completed this journey and showed people that, you know, because I'm not one of those people who subscribe to the idea of something being impossible. It's like Nelson Mandela said, it only seems impossible until someone does it. And since finishing that trip, like I've said so many times, it's not like a magic pull. It's not like I was okay.
Yeah.
Ta-da, I'm fixed. You know, it's struggling with mental health issues or mental illness is a lifelong journey.
Yeah.
And so since finishing my trip around Africa, for the longest time, I've been thinking, trying to figure out what's the next big thing. You know, what is the next big dream? And everyone else has been asking me, you know, what's the next big thing? I've, you know, thought maybe I should have started with something a bit smaller, because how do you top that? But since I was a little girl, my first dream as a girl growing up was to be a scientist. And working with, it's only like for the last 3 years that I've gotten involved in the mental health industry, but I've finally decided that I actually want to take the plunge, apply to med school, go to medical school, and then specialize as a psychiatrist. And that's, you know, it's a big thing to take on when you're in your late 30s, almost 40. But it is such a passion of mine to share all my knowledge and experience that I have on this topic with people, because I'm in a unique position where I understand what it's like to suffer from mental illness. I know what it's like to have lost people as a result of mental illness. And I know what it's like to also counsel people, encourage people to overcome mental health issues. So that's why I decided to, you know, I wrote my book, and now I'm selling the ebook as a way of raising money for med school so I can finish medical school.
Absolutely stunning. I mean, that for me is, you know, it's not just sort of a campaign, a thing that happens where we have a conversation like this, Joe, and it's all wonderful and we feel good. And then, you know, that's where it ends. A couple of people go get an opportunity to listen back to the podcast, raise awareness. But a week, a month from now, we forget again. You know, this is a lifelong thing. And apart from that, it's your opportunity to then to participate in the wellness of others, the mental wellness of others as well, and share in those particular experiences. I mean, it sounds like a cliche. It's something that I've said way too many times on air, but it's just a blatant fact. We do not talk about mental health enough. We don't put it at the center. I mean, let's talk about your journey and the impact it had on your own mental health, and then we'll get back to what your campaign is on your website. What did it do for you? Because as you said, it wasn't a silver bullet. It wasn't a panacea that healed you and hereby you shall never have issues again. But I'm sure it played a therapeutic role in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, I struggled with severe social phobia. And for people who don't know what that is, it's imagine yourself... like, I could literally, as a child and growing up, if I walked into a supermarket, I would have a panic attack because I would be so high-strung and have such bad anxiety because of the people around me. So any social situation would make me really just have severe panic attacks. So imagine, and then being on your own every day in a foreign country that you don't know, on your own, having to deal with, let's say, especially border days. Like, border days were always my worst because you have like a gazillion people around you, and you don't know where you're going, you don't know what you're doing, you don't maybe you don't understand, you know, what people
are saying, the
language, yeah, the languages. But what that taught me is how to calm myself down, how to use different tools like breathing exercises and grounding exercises, and you know, just focusing on tasks at hand and at that kind of thing. And in a way, it was like this massive, very long, very intense exposure therapy session going around Africa. And what it didn't cure me, obviously, but it taught me so much about myself, and it taught me how to persevere. It taught me that I'm capable of way more than I think I am, and it taught me, you know, to always trust my gut, especially traveling on your own. You know, you have to kind of trust your gut. But it also taught me to let people in. Because, like I said, 99% of people just wanted to help. But it had such a significant effect on my confidence, on my ability to be able to actually face all my fears, because I would rather go through my fear than go around it. Because eventually, if you try to go around it, you'll end up facing it sometime in the future again. So unless, you know, my thing has always been, and somehow since I was a kid, I mean, as a kid, people always think that I'm so weird when I tell this story, but I used to suffer from severe claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
So because I have this scientific mind that needs to understand things,
sure,
I would lock myself in a cupboard as a little girl to teach myself how to calm myself down.
Wow.
And to teach my brain, you know, in a realistic and rational way, realize that it's okay. It's not like it's a fatal situation. We're not going to die by sitting in a cupboard. And, you know, teach myself how to calm down, how to, you know, calm down my breathing. So in that way, it helped me tremendously.
I mean, absolutely stunning, because the one thing that I just thought of now is how you've always then had this history. Look, it works for some people. It doesn't work for others. It clearly worked in your instance, where you would force yourself to develop coping mechanisms for those, you know, those massive phobias that you then had. So you have this phobia. You recognize that you have it. Some part of your mind tells you that it's irrational. And so you confront it deliberately. And I mean, I can imagine those border days that you were talking about. It's people shouting and screaming. Someone wants to be the big man and show you that he's the boss, and you're at his mercy to enter his country. Another one is trying to solicit a bribe. Another one is trying to, you know, is just basically xenophobic, if not racist. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. And yeah, in other instances, I'm sure guys were nice and kind, and they waved you through. Without being funny, but I guess it's all these different experiences, and you basically went back to being that little girl that locked herself in the closet in an effort to deal with her claustrophobia.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what that taught me, that experience taught me, is the one thing that I was missing since I grew up is, unfortunately, I grew up in a family where talking about mental health or mental illness was not permitted. It was not something that, you know, you were not allowed to talk about it. And I was not allowed to seek professional help. And I think that is probably why I started doing these things, like trying to teach myself how to deal with these things. Because I wasn't allowed to seek help. But even after going around Africa and putting myself through I call them my personal therapy sessions. The one part that I was really missing was the professional help. And it was only when I started seeing someone professionally, and I was taught and equipped with the tools on how to deal with difficulties, you know, things that we're not taught in school. For example, a couple of years ago, like I said, this whole Africa, going around Africa wasn't a miracle cure. It didn't fix me. So a couple of years ago, I ended up in a situation where I attempted suicide. And it was a very nearly successful attempt. Great. Thankfully, it didn't work. And thankfully, I really suck at it. I really suck at suicide. I always say that to people. And it's meant to be funny.
I'm sitting here and thinking, I can't possibly laugh at that.
It's meant to be. Yeah. It's like the one thing that I really suck at. And I'm so grateful for that. And I have to figure out the reason why I suck at it is because I'm supposed to share my knowledge and experience with others. And share my life story with others so I can help them, because, like I said, I have this, I'm in this position where I, you know, it's a unique position where I understand it from every possible angle. And so that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I, and like you said, rightfully, we don't talk about it enough. And we've gotten to a point where I always say, you know, as a society, we're more comfortable talking about mental health. Like, okay, let's practice mindfulness, you know, look after ourselves, do yoga, meditate. But as soon as you talk about mental illness, everyone goes dead quiet.
You know, I heard something amazing now the other day, as I was driving back, you know, when I was driving back from work, from the show, I was listening to one of the podcasts, and someone had just pointed out that, you know, we have all of these. It was just actually last night or early this morning. I was listening to one of the podcasts from 702, and it's so true. We all know who the first aid person is in the office. So if you break your arm, if you fall, if you faint, whatever the case is, you know, all the drama that happens in an office at some point. We all know who has to do what at what stage, you know, and that person will come in. But the irony is, let someone break down and have a good cry in the office, and no one knows what the hell to do. Instead, we're all sort of looking to the sky and looking the other way and like, oh, goodness, this is awkward. But meanwhile, we're not dealing with those issues. And I find it fascinating that for yourself as a mental health champion today, you were in the unfortunate position of, you know, being in a family it's not bad on your family or whatever the case is. It's just that that is the experience for so many South Africans, that mental health is not something that is discussed. You know, if you need to deal with your own issues, and that's it, done.
And, you know, the scary and very, very sad part of it is, until we start talking about it openly, nothing is going to change. And, you know, if we look at it statistically, it is just another pandemic, and people are just not taking it very seriously. Well, it has changed. It has changed. Mm. It's gotten a lot better, but we still have a long way to go.
No, for sure.
I mean, if you just take suicide numbers just as one example, if you had to say to people, I mean, people would be shocked. Pre 2020, the statistics were every 60 seconds, someone took their own life somewhere in the world. Right now, we're standing at every 40 seconds or less.
Jeez.
So, I mean, by the time we're done talking, you know, more than, you know, dozens of people will have taken their own lives. And it's like I said, until we start talking about it openly and start putting tools in place, like, you know, I really want to campaign for mental health to be taught in schools, because we're not taught in school how to regulate our emotions and how to deal with, you know, breaking down, and how to deal with cyberbullying, especially these days.
And being there for others.
Relationships and being there for others, exactly. Exactly that.
I'm just quickly going to take Thabo from Pretoria, if you don't mind. He just wants to come in quickly. And then after that, I want to ask you about your campaign that you're running on your website, how it ties into all of this, and what's up for grabs, so that people can participate, if you don't mind. Thabo in Pretoria, good evening. Thabo? Good evening, Thabo.
Yeah, evening. Yes, I don't know. I think the speaker was switched off. Okay, good evening, and your guest. Let me just ask this question. I'm actually one of the people that is actually having fear of an enclosed place. That fear I'm actually supposed to be taking some flights, long flights and everything, and I don't know how am I going to approach that. How can I train my mind to deal with that situation? I'm telling you, I'm suffering. Even, you know, being in a loo, a new toilet, like if I'm in a public toilet at a filling station or so, and I happen to be like, the door is locked. I'm telling you, when I have to open, if I can struggle with this lock, the lock system, you know, some of them are anti-clockwise or something. I sweat. I'm telling you, the other day, I had to scream. And it's so traumatic, I'm telling you. And I don't know, because I think that was started by one of the day I actually had this new car, and then the boot was too big, and then so I had this friend that I actually told that the boot is so big in such a way that you can fit inside, and he said, oh, let me see if you can fit. Then I actually put myself, and it just banged at the boot, and that thing did create a lot of fear on me, and he struggled to find the handle to the button to open the boot. So in that moment I nearly lost it. I nearly killed him, because it's like, that is when I picked up that I've got this. How can I train my mind to deal with this issue? Especially on flights. Even just Cape Town, Devon, I'm suffering.
Okay, great one. Thanks, Thabo. I'm going to end it there with Thabo. I guess you got the question there, Joe. You know, it's just for the sake of time. Again, one of those, I mean, do you have advice for him at all?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, so first off, I just want to say I'm not a registered mental health professional yet. Okay.
Thanks for the disclaimer.
Firstly, I would say to him to actually go and seek out professional help, someone who can stick with him and help him through it. But yes, I do have some tips because I've been through this personally. So step one, something you can do is, in your mind, visualize yourself sitting in a closed space, and that will evoke those emotions that you feel. And the thing is to remind yourself that fear is a very natural response, and it's a good thing. Anxiety is a good thing. You know, it's supposed to be there. It's a very natural thing. But when it turns into something that becomes an irrational fear, like being afraid of a confined space, to remind yourself that it's okay to be afraid, number one. Number two, just for time as well, is a simple breathing exercise. Is breathe in through your nose for four counts, hold it for four counts, and breathe out for four counts, and then you repeat that four times. So that also just helps relax, bring down your heart rate, and help you focus on just where you are in the moment.
Very, very sage advice. Thank you so much for that. So, the campaign on your website, how does it work? What can we do to aid and be part of it?
Yes. So, well, once I decided, okay, this is it, I'm going to med school, I started looking at the cost of it, and I realized, right, okay, going to need a lot of money. And I thought, okay, what are creative ways that I can use? Because I'm not one that, I don't want to fundraise as such. You know, I like to give and get. So I realized, well, I have a book. And so the campaign is to sell 10,000 ebooks. So it is it's my book of my journey around Africa.
Which would be a compelling read.
Yeah, well, hope so. So it's from... from my childhood until completing my trip around Africa. So the ebook is available on my website. So every person that buys an ebook, you immediately get the ebook download, and you also get a numbered, dated, and autographed photograph that I personally sent you as well. Doesn't matter where you are in the world.
And it's just a case of going onto your website.
It's just a case of going onto my website, and people will see that it's the 10,000 ebook campaign. And I'm hoping to raise that money within this year.
I wish you all the best, and I'm sure you're going to do it. Can you give us your website for again quickly?
Very easy. So if people want to go on, it's just joerust.com, JORUST.com.
Easy and as simple as that. So when's the next trip coming up, and have you sold the rights to Leonardo DiCaprio yet for the movie?
Sorry, I lost you there. Say again.
I'm saying, have you sold the rights for the movie yet to Leonardo DiCaprio, and when's the next trip?
No, haven't sold the rights yet. But literally, seriously, I'm working on it. But as far as the next trip, that's on hold, especially probably for the next 12 years, because I want to become a psychiatrist.
I get you. And we have this thing called COVID, so you can't even say it's a holiday trip. Yeah. Listen, it was absolutely stunning chatting to you, Joe. All the best to you. And, you know, I wish you all the best for your future journeys, your studies, and all of that jazz. And well done on you and the great work you're doing, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Only a pleasure. Thank you so much. That was Joe Rust.